Kaya, Wanju, hello, welcome to another episode of The Curb. My name's Andrew F. Pierce, and this is a podcast where I bring you in-depth interviews with filmmakers, creatives, and creators of culture. This podcast is recorded in Boolu, Western Australia, sovereignty never ceded. Writer, director Dominie Marshall is a talent on the rise, with short films like Go With Grace, Slap, and now her finest work yet, Howl Under a Belt, Marshall is a force to be reckoned with. Her work is deeply personal, written from a perspective that invites audiences to engage with the internal mindset of her characters, and through that process, we're able to see the world completely differently. Guiding Dominie's creative output is producer Josie Baines, an equally impressive talent on the rise. Alongside Dominie, Josie has worked with emerging talents like Annalise Hickey on her films Stranger Brother and Hafakasi, while also giving space to cinematographer Matthew Chuang to build a body of work that is also reshaping how Australian stories are seen on screen. After you listen to this interview, I highly recommend you seek out Dominie's work on her website, dominiemarshall.com, where you can also seek out her web series, Her Words, released during 2017 and 2019. It's a deeply informative series with 50 episodes, and it's one that pairs well with books like Taboo by Hannah Ferguson. I want to quickly apologise to Hannah for misremembering her name during the following interview. In this chat, I talk with Dominie and Josie about their creative process, how they managed to bring us into the internal mindset of their characters, and a heck of a lot more. Howl is screening at the Melbourne International Film Festival as part of the Aussie Shorts package alongside Stranger Brother, I'm the Most Racist Person I Know, Mango Seed, and a lot of other great shorts. The screenings are held in person on the 11th of August and the 22nd of August 2025, with online screenings taking place from the 24th of August. For more details, visit miff.com.au or visit the link in the show notes. If you want to find out more about the work that we do on The Curb, then head over to thecurb.com.au or follow us in Instagram, Facebook and Blue Sky at thecurb.au. We're a completely independent ad-free website that lives on support of listeners and readers just like yourself. So visit patreon.com/thecurb.au where you can support our work from as little as $1 a month. If you're unable to financially support us, that's okay. Please consider sharing this interview with your film-loving friends. New interview episodes drop on Thursday mornings with bonus episodes appearing on Tuesdays. We'd also love it if you could rate and review us on the podcast player of your choice. Every review helps amplify the interviews and stories from filmmakers to a wider audience. Here's a clip from the trailer for Howl, followed by my chat with Dominie Marshall and Josie Baines.
You're cute.
Thanks.
Hope not to leave my side tonight.
What?
Oh my god, this is so stupid. Okay.
First of all, thank you again both so much for joining me to talk about your work. It means a lot. It's really huge. I've appreciated, Josie, the work that you've done as a producer and being able to get certain stories on screen, but also there is, you know, a presentation of the stories that you choose. The people that you're working with is really important. So I'll open up by kind of just asking you, first of all, your decision process behind who you want to work with and putting on the you know, putting you in an awkward spot because somebody who you've chosen to work with is right here as well. But how do you decide what stories you want to tell and who you want to work with?
Oh gosh, that is a beautiful question. Honestly, I think it all stems from me, for people who I connect with on a personal level, like face to face first. I think I sort of find it a very organic sort of process when I start chatting to people, and some people I really, really click with, even perhaps before I've started talking about a script or not, and some you know, I think are great, but maybe don't click with as much. And so I've sort of gravitated to the projects I work with from person first or director first. That's exactly what happened with Dom. It's exactly what happened with Annalise, who's another director I work with a lot. In both cases, I got to know Dom and Anno first, a project after that. But I think outside of that, I really gravitate towards stories that, for me, I think have a perspective or a point of view that I personally haven't seen before for whatever reason. Anna's saying something really important, and that is obviously something that different people think different things are important and very subjective, but I just think about what I would like to see on the screens, what maybe I haven't seen on the screens, and that's what I gravitate towards when I'm choosing a project. And I've just been so incredibly fortunate to be surrounded by amazing people who are creating amazing things. So that's also, luck is a really big part of it as well, I think, in a way.
And Tom, for you as a storyteller, like let's go into your foundation as a storyteller. What was the kind of kernel of deciding this is the vessel that I want to use, film, TV, web series, that kind of stuff. This is the vessel that I want to use to tell stories, to explore personal experiences. What made you decide that?
So I've actually always been a writer. So I've been a writer from a very young age, and I think my mum really encouraged that in me. She's an artist, so that kind of creativity was part of my household kind of growing up. And I've always loved film. Like, I watched a lot of film through my teen years. I was a big horror fan, a big drama fan, and I kind of I think left. I grew up in Perth, and left Perth and moved to Melbourne. And I never really kind of realized that film was a space you could work in. I understood that you could be a writer, but I didn't really understand that you could direct film. I hadn't really kind of discovered that. I'd done some drama at school. I thought I might act for a time being, but definitely not for me. And I moved here. I did my undergrad and my honors in creative writing. And after that, I decided to explore film, and I chose film for a couple of reasons. One, it's a medium that I just adore, and I, connect with so much. But also, because it is so universal, I think, and it speaks to a much broader audience than, let's say, a novel. I think, anyway, I don't know if that's necessarily true, but that's how I've always felt. I still love reading, and I still love writing short fiction and kind of literary fiction. But film to me feels like a medium that can meet a lot of people wherever they are without judgment. And I love that about the medium. So I kind of fell into film that way. I did a short course at BCA and kind of dipped my toes into film there, made a short film called Purple. And then I took a little bit of time off. Started experimenting with web series, kind of music video, art films, and then decided to go back to VCA and do my master's in film because I just felt like I wanted to explore that more and I wanted to meet more people in that space and grow my networks. And then through that process, made two short films, Slap and Go With Grace, that both premiered at MIF, Slap in the Accelerator program and Go With Grace in the Australian Shorts program. And then that kind of, I guess, set things in motion. So from there, continued to create. Was very fortunate to meet Josie along the way, and we had a gorgeous coffee and kind of discussed HAL. I actually wrote HAL as my graduate script at BCA, and it, but I couldn't make it due to COVID, so we couldn't have actors within 1.5 meters of each other. So I decided to park that one for a later time, and then met Joyce, and then it kind of that kicked off from there. So I think it's kind of been an organic process, a lovely process of kind of finding the right people to work with, and the right stories to tell. But film to me is just such a powerful medium. I think, it's has the potential to change how someone sees the world, I think, and learn more about people on a really human level.
You come back to you being from Perth. I'm in Perth.
Ah, yes.
So I talk to plenty of people from Perth who say that, I didn't think I could be a filmmaker, right? And adding an extra layer to that, I speak to so many women and queer and non-binary people who also say, I didn't think I could be a filmmaker. For both of you, was there a point that you both kind of had to address that question of, I can't be a filmmaker, or I have to ask permission to be a filmmaker. What was your negotiation point with dealing with that process in Australia?
That's such a great question. I think for me that it definitely was something I negotiated, and probably not necessarily consciously, but more subconsciously. And I think that was probably part of the reason why I went back to VCA to do my master's, because I felt like I needed this credibility. I needed this kind of, someone else to say, yes, you're a filmmaker. Yes, you can go and make these things. Yes, you have something to offer. And I think kind of through that process, I didn't come out of that thinking, yes, I'm a filmmaker now and I can be a filmmaker and I can tell the stories I want to tell. But I think meeting other people who were like me in the space, trying to do the same thing and realizing, actually, you know what, we've all got something to offer and we've all got something to say, was really transformative for me. So I think kind of through that process of meeting my people, meeting film people, growing that kind of community. Helped me then begin to take myself, not take myself more seriously because I've always taken myself seriously, but I suppose let go of some of that imposter syndrome that I felt a bit stronger before.
Yeah. And Josie, I mean, as a producer, it's part of your role is getting into rooms, right? And negotiating. And so that adds an extra layer to it. Can you talk about that process for you as well of asking for permission, making space, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I'd say that it's still a journey I'm on every day, and I speak to a lot of people, often skewed to women and non-binary people who are in the industry that have huge imposter syndrome. I think that for me, it was less like I always knew I wanted to work in film since I was very small. Like I was making movies as kid, movies when I was a kid. And for me, I was always going to make film. And I was re really lucky that I was surrounded by people who were like, you could do whatever you want. You go do that. You want to do that? Fantastic. I almost had an opposite effect where I went in thinking, yeah, I can do this. I'm going to be in Hollywood when I'm 21 and it's going to be great. And then as I continued through, also I did a BCA course as well, the undergrad, I realized, oh, actually this is incredibly difficult. There's a lot of incredible people who are also doing this, and I need to check myself, and almost got more imposter syndrome as I went along. But I know that is part of, learning and growing and realizing the stakes. So it's something I question all the time, like, am I good enough to be where I'm at? And as you're saying, Andrew, going into rooms, talking to people, having a level of confidence, is something that I put a front on, but behind it, I'm still battling with how to keep that confidence. I think I've had huge improvement in that space for me, actually being able to go to festivals, and feel like there's, an element of credibility now, has really helped my own confidence, whether or not that's changed anything on the outside. But for me internally, thinking, oh, maybe, the stories that I like to see and watch are also stories that other people want to see and watch. That credibility has actually done a lot for me in surprising ways that I didn't know it would.
Yeah. I mean, well, let's talk about Berlin briefly then, because, it's massive to be included in such a great festival like that. And I guess on a polar scale, we've got the shorts that you both worked on, right? And then like Lesbian Space Princess, I don't know if you saw that, but that equally is also like a very proudly queer women-led film, right? And to have, shorts and features both represented on a global stage, which amplifying and supporting women's voices from Australian film, it means so much. So, what does it mean to you both to be able to be part of a festival like that?
I mean, I'm reflecting on it kind of as I'm speaking, but it honestly did mean so much, Andrew. And I think, you've just beautifully articulated how special it was to be there. And kind of, there were, I think, two shorts, and two features in the web series, and four of those, the two features and the two shorts, were all directed by women, which was which was amazing actually to see. And honestly, it was a dream come true. Like I had been kind of wanting to screen at Berlinale for my career, really, in terms of thinking that that was a festival that felt right for me and for the kinds of stories that I want to tell and the kinds of films that I make. And so it really was a dream come true. Like when we got the email, I didn't really think it was real. I think I was in bed with my partner and I kind of sat up and screamed and I was like, I think we just got into Berlin. And it was late, it was not late, but their kind of period, their submissions period goes right up until a month before the festival. So we found out like 4 weeks before the festival started. So it was just this kind of wild time of kind of rushing to get all the material together and book the flights and get over there. So yeah, it was extraordinary. It was also obviously, well, not obviously, but definitely the biggest festival I had been to. And just an incredible festival to be part of. The programmers, the people who make the festival are so invested in their filmmakers. They, really take you around. They really support you. They are there to make sure that you get the most out of the festival experience. There's five screenings across the kind of 10-day, 12-day period, and Q&As after every screening with amazingly thoughtful questions from audiences. Yeah, and the energy there was just amazing. It really felt like it was a festival that the whole city got behind, and I think that was it was quite inspiring, I think, to see how I suppose film festivals are treated in Europe and the way that maybe the arts is celebrated more or in us. Like obviously we've got a massive and an amazing culture here in Australia, but I think it is distinct in terms of the way that their government supports it, and it's slightly different over there. So it was pretty, yeah, it was life-changing, I think, for me. What about you, Jess?
Oh, I mean, you've articulated it really well. Life-changing for me as well. I think something you mentioned, Andrew, just about women's stories on screen, like that's the basically what I live by in my working career and what I want to do. And as Don was saying, like to be over there with incredible international filmmakers, but also a very strong female Australian collection of filmmakers was I felt really proud for Australia and really proud for female women filmmakers in Australia. But I just can't explain like how inspiring and wonderful it is to see these stories that are told, and there's lots of women's stories out there, but told by female teams. I think just has a different like perspective and a different like delicacy, I think is a kind of a weird word, but a word I'd use. And it just makes me so proud and excited for the future. And I think coming back, the biggest, like the way Dom described how the festival worked is exactly my experience too, but motivated and inspired. You just can't come back from those places without being like just eyes open to opportunities, the networking that you can do in those festivals. It was way beyond what I thought. Like the opportunities that have come from it is way beyond what I thought. So I had no idea how much of a tool it can be to progress your career as well.
I think that's the thing which I find. I've spoken to a bunch of filmmakers over the years who have gone to Berlin, and one of the things that has also been said is that even though they're from Australia, there might be other Australian filmmakers there. That's often the first time that they're actually getting to engage with other Australian filmmakers too, and that in itself is like it's a little bit absurd. But I understand we're a big nation. Like it's where there's a lot of us here. Like there's a lot of space, so it's hard to connect. But it's also kind of detaching yourself from Australia and being able to communicate and connect with not just Australian filmmakers, but other filmmakers. Which kind of leads into another question which I have about. I know that you've done work with the Equality Institute, Dom, and we don't need to talk about that too much, but specifically I do want to talk about the word equality. Because equality is something that is talked about from funding body perspectives in different ways. And I'm curious for you both what the word equality means to you in a creative sense, what does that look like in front of the camera and behind the camera for you in a creative sense?
I mean, it's a great question, Andrew. I was kind of thinking about it, like what does it mean in a creative sense? because if I, if I think about equality, if I think about my feminism, ultimately it comes down to, equal rights, respect, and opportunities for all people. And so if I think about that in relation to filmmaking or to creativity and to my creative process, I guess it's seeing that both in front and behind the camera. I think it's making space for voices who have historically been excluded, amplifying and making space for the stories actually on screen for those to be prioritized, that have been historically, and continue to be excluded. I think there's a lot of research out there that shows that if you've got greater diversity behind the camera, you're going to see greater diversity of stories on screen as well. So we know that that is true. But yeah, I'm still kind of reflecting on what that, I suppose, what that means beyond that as well for me. I don't know. I might keep thinking. And Josie, if you've got anything to add.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think from a more logistical perspective, and I don't want to lean into ads too much, but my day job is also doing production in a combination of obviously short creative projects and ads, and just as like a complete total different perspective, but there's been the ad in the ad land, there's all these awards that happen all the time. And there's one that just happened over in New Zealand called the Axis Awards. And there was 12 awards for directors and not 6 awards for DOPs, I believe. And it was all men still in 2025. That's not what's happening in the narrative world, but I guess what I'm trying to say is like from a logistical perspective, I'm constantly trying whenever there's an opportunity to again get people on set in every role that is possible, from lower, like when they're just starting out in the industry and they want to just see what set looks like, upwards, just actively trying to hire underrepresented people in every role, where we can. And that is how you start and how you can grow and you can build and then you become, and hopefully eventually down the track, you've got people in all heads of departments that are more, diverse. And I think that really helps from a logistical perspective of being on set. And we really did try to do that with Hal. I think Dom, after the project, we were writing up some notes, and there was a percentage, I think 53% of our crew were women or non-binary people, which is actually logistically, when you're building a film crew from people that you can ask favors for, or get discount rates from, or like work in how short films work, to be able to do that and also continue to have a close to 50-50 split, I think is awesome. And yeah, I'm pretty proud of us for doing that from a logistical perspective. And then, yeah, completely what you're saying, Dom, creatively, like allowing space for stories that haven't been told by maybe voices that have been underrepresented in the past is spot on, and allows us to sort of eventually down the track, who knows, like kind of just even out. So anyone who has a story that has a story that hasn't been told yet, no matter who they are, can tell that story and have the support to do so.
I think, yeah, and the other thing I was just going to add was I think, I think the merit argument is bullshit. And I also think that there's, I don't, obviously, not everyone looks at it in this way, but I think sometimes I hear things from people who feel like maybe they're now the ones being excluded from getting the opportunities. And I think that's a really unfortunate way to look at things. Like, this is ultimately, I think the stories that we see, they're better stories, they're stronger stories. And they represent the full, beautiful diversity of the human experience. So I guess I would challenge everyone to look at that as like, this is a really positive thing. It's an amazing thing. And I was on a kind of webinar the other day or something, and there was some great advice that someone had said around, often we think that we've got a lot to learn, and we all do, of course, everyone does, but often we actually have a lot to teach as well. So, in the process of making films, like, always think about who can you bring up with you. And so I think that was a really lovely thing for me to be reminded of, but I think for everyone to be reminded of.
Yeah. To me, like adding on to that as well, like, not that films need to be a teaching point or a lesson or anything like that. They can be, of course, but part of the joy of getting to be able to watch films from different perspectives is getting to see the world from a different perspective, right? And if we shift over to start talking about how, and specifically the opening of that film, because I really appreciate how deeply and completely you put us into the mindset and the view of a woman just trying to, or a young girl turning into a woman trying to just live in the world, right? And we learned so much in the first 30 seconds. She's not wearing earpods, she's hopping on a train. There's a shadowy kind of person over there. So she's always vigilant, right? And in those first 30 seconds, we immediately get an understanding of what kind of life is like for a woman in the world today. And we read about it. Well, we should be reading about it. And whether actually men are reading about it or not, I'm not too sure. But, putting it in this kind of internal perspective, getting to see it from this character's perspective just shifts how we actually see the world. And we continually hear about violence against women, and yet nothing changes. And to me, one of the key ways of actually changing that is through storytelling. And Howl isn't distinctly about violence against women, but it's also, you are presenting how a generation who has grown up where there's been inaction against violence against women lives and engages with the world. It's a huge long question to kind of say, what is the foundation of being able to put us in the mindset of this character and present those things so we get to see how she experiences and engages with the world?
Yes, it is. There's so much that you've kind of touched on there, Andrew. I'll try and kind of touch on all of those things. But it was important, I think, for us to put the viewer immediately in Daisy's world. The film is very much from her perspective, from start to finish. So that was important. And the kind of, I guess, the opening part of that film was to set up that kind of tone and that mood and that experience of just how it feels, to some walking through the world as a woman. It's certainly something that I felt my whole life. Like you just are vigilant. And I think you hear lots of really great stories about, I can't remember it now exactly, but that kind of anecdote of, someone's asking people in a room, a group of people of all genders, what do you do to stay safe? And I think like the men had maybe like a couple of things, and it's like the women's list is so long around like just all the little things that you think about, and you don't even think they're things. They're just things that you do on a daily basis to stay safe. Where it is, not wearing AirPods if you're alone, not running at night, keeping your keys in your hand, texting someone when you get home, texting someone when you leave. Like there's just so many things that we do on a daily basis to stay safe. So I guess that was just a way of setting up, I think, the world that Daisy operates in, which is this, patriarchal world. And the film really is about exploring that intense experience of being a teenage girl in this world. And all the ways in which that kind of comes through. And yes, while it's not directly about violence against women per se, it does explore sexual violence, it does explore consent, and it does explore the ways in which these quite aggressive behaviors are normalized. These kind of hegemonic masculinity is normalized in these spaces. So so that was really important as well. It's always been, I think, like a lot of my films have delved into this. It's something that I am really interested in. It is the work that I do at Equality Institute. We're a social enterprise that works to advance gender equality and violence against women and girls. So it's what I do in my kind of day job, and it is what I explore in my films as well. And I think that we could, and I don't think, while the conversation sure has come a long way from when I was a teenager, it's certainly got a long way to go. It's a lot of renewed, I don't know if you've seen Adolescence yet, but I certainly watched it, and the conversation happening around that is pretty extraordinary, not only from the way that that was shot, but what it delves into, I think, and what we're seeing in terms of some really extreme misogynist, anti-women ideologies coming through in very young people. So I think there's a lot, still to explore. There's a lot to be said, and I do think that storytelling can play a really powerful role in that.
Josie, do you want to add to that as well?
Gosh, that was a beautiful answer. No, I don't have so much more to add other than just layering on the idea that it is obviously this topic, a gender equality in general, is something that is explored in film and the news and novels all the time. But I just on what Dom said, like I don't think that means that we're not at a point where we can stop talking about it, and I think we've got a long way to go. And I think telling these stories in different ways from slightly different perspectives, whether it is adolescence, whether it is Hal, where it's from, 16-year-old girls, or it's just we've got to continue to make stories about this from slightly different perspectives and keep telling these stories until we're at a point where it's not something that we have to think about, and there's still a long way to go. So, yeah.
And I think, I mean, if I can bring it back to talking about Berlin for a moment, and specifically the two films that sit at the top of my mind, obviously Hal and then Lesbian Space Princess, very polar different films. Yet, right? Yet, and I don't know if you've seen Lesbian Space Princess or not, but there is a huge amount of discussion in the film about bodies, and just as the way that you talk about bodies in Hal is really pushing the language and how we talk about it, and actually putting a spotlight on the words that are used for teen girls talking about their own bodies. And there are things in this that I'm currently reading Taboo at the moment. In her book, she's specifically talking about how women talk about their bodies and the ability to actually be in tune with what's going on, not being aware of anything to do with periods and things like that. And all of those kinds of discussions are really vital, important discussions that need to be had. And in Lesbian Space Princess, that's done in a comical way. In Hal, you're doing it here in a way that is just like the scene where the two girls are getting prepared for the night out and stuff, and the conversation is so casual about their genitals and just like, what does it look like? And I was just like, that I've never seen that kind of conversation taking place on screen. And I know that it's a conversation that's taking place in bedrooms and at sleepovers and stuff like that. So talking and expanding about how we see bodies on screen and how we talk about bodies on screen is vitally important. But it's embedded here in the script. Can you expand on that a little bit, Dom? Explaining and exploring the importance of knowing and recognizing that how we talk about bodies is equally important as how we see bodies on screen.
God, what a great point. And I did we actually didn't get along to Lesbian Space Princess in Berlin, which was I tried so hard to get there, and every session I couldn't make. And I'm so desperate to see that film because it just
Yeah. It was a ever it was booking out too. Like every it was the talk of the town, really. So yeah.
But yes, I mean, I think it's incredibly important to, the not only how we see bodies, but how we talk about bodies on screen. I mean, that particular conversation was literally something that I was asked. So, and I just from it just really stuck with me that when I was asked that question, because I was a little bit older than the girls in the film, maybe I was 19. But I was also so naive in my answer. I didn't really understand what I was kind of being asked. Like, I'd never really thought about it before. And I suppose, like, in many ways, I think, particularly in Western white culture, we as women are very much taught to be disconnected from our bodies, to kind of perform, to look a certain way, to feel a certain way. I mean, I don't think that's necessarily changing. I think, we might get a little bit greater education at school now around consent. Like I said, I don't know what the conversation's happening around hormones and periods. I didn't get taught anything about that. I feel like I was 30 by the time I actually really understood the way my hormones work and how they impacted how I show up on a 4 week cycle. Like that's still, it's so extraordinary to me that that is not spoken about, and women are not taught that about their own bodies. We're not taught about pleasure. Women are not taught about pleasure. I think we're taught that in heterosexual relationships, well, I certainly was taught that sex was for the benefit of men. Like I was not taught that pleasure was something that I could center. And I think that conversation needs to change too. So yeah, I think there's a long way to go when it comes to talking about bodies. I think bodies, there's what I would love to see is kind of this getting to a space where bodies are just our bodies, right? They let us live in the world. They are these beautiful fleshy embodiment of, physical representations of who we are, but they're just bodies. There's no good way to be. There's no bad way to be. They're just a body. And I think the conversation's getting there, but I don't think we're there just yet.
Yeah, because I again, it's what we get to see on screen as well, and the physicality of certain things. And let's then talk about the way that Daisy dresses and, her choice of clothes as opposed to the choice of clothes of her friend and the other people at the party and things. And it's clear, like, she's not confident in her body, right? She's wearing a t-shirt rather than something that accentuates anything. And again, these are things like, I mean, I'm 41 and I know that the conversations that we had in sex ed in high school was all focused around penises and how to deal with that. And it's like, okay, great, but what about everything else? And I don't remember what the girls in high school felt about it, but I can only imagine that they felt just hollowed out. Like, what about me? Where's my space here? And I then, thinking back of the way that they dress, it was always, for somebody else, to get the attention of somebody else. And so then it's refreshing to see Daisy presented in this way. And it says so much about how she's dressed and how she engages with the world and presents herself. It's reserved, it's held back. She's not confident in a way that is able to say, this is me. And we get that as she kind of explores her queer identity there. But additionally, it's just that presentation. So can you talk about the importance of being able to explore how somebody engages with the world by the way that they look as well? Like we talked about their internal side, but how they look as well and they present themselves outside is equally important. So can you talk about that a little bit too?
Yeah, I think she is, like Daisy is much more reserved, compared to Lila, if we look at the two female leads. I think the difference too, of course that costume was chosen very specifically for Daisy, but I think part of it is that she's not interested in being an object looked at by men. So part of it is definitely that she feels, kind of definitely there's insecurity there, absolutely. And I think we see that in the bedroom scene when she's kind of looking at Lila and seeing Lila try on one of her skirts that's a little bit too big and kind of feeling that hot shame of, oh, like, is my body too big? Is my, what does this mean for me? Kind of that sitting in that comparison, I think that the patriarchy tells us to do with women. Like we're always competing with women to be better for men's attention or for whatever that looks like. So we kind of feel that in that moment, but part of it is, yeah, very much not her not wanting to be seen by men or observed by men in the way that she feels like an object. So it is, I think, kind of a form of resistance, her costume. And I think we see Daisy beautifully stepping into, I think, her queer identity through the scene later on with Drew at the pool. And that's really lovely because I think Drew represents for Daisy someone who has found themselves, and who kind of is cool and confident and charming, And creates a space, I think, for Daisy to feel both, really safe but also desired. And I think that's a really special place to be. And through that kind of relationship, Daisy is able to kind of, I think, feel like, okay, actually, there is space for me to be who I am. And maybe this looks a little bit different to who Lila is or to who these people are at the rest of the party. And that's okay as well. So I think, yeah, the costume is important. Body language is important. There's lots of, you can tell how Daisy is not interested in performing, I suppose, for the men at that party at any point. Yeah, I think that comes out through, multiple moments, but ultimately they come back together, I think, Daisy and Lily. And I think in that way, like, it is, for me, even though the film explores lots of different layers around consent and sexual violence and sexuality and body image and all of those things, ultimately it's a love letter to your best friend. Daisy and Lila come back together. And despite the patriarchy telling us that we, need to compete with women in all the different ways that we need to, they choose each other in the end. And I think that's really what the movie is about.
I think that probably the last thing I'll add, and I'm sure there's lots. I mean, Dom, you've got a beautiful speaker and all your love letter to the best friend. I remember we were talking about that in Berlin, and like I think that's a beautiful way to explain this film. And I think I would just say that it's so incredible to work with someone like you, Dom, on such a beautiful project. And you're such a talent, and all of the stories that you're writing are so unique and need to be told. And I'm just so lucky to have been a part of this one. And yeah, just for like the Australian film industry, I just think that just we're in such a, it's kind of a bit scary out there at the moment in the like landscape of like how do you get something made? But I think it's about pushing through, and when you're lucky enough to be able to work on a project like this and then be able to take it somewhere, you just really understand the power of telling stories, and it's just the best, and it just fills my heart. So keep going, I guess, to anyone who's listening to this, just keep trying to make it in whatever way you can. And thanks for having us on, Andrew. I'm
Oh,
sorry
yeah.
I have to leave early, but
No, don't be sorry at all.
it's incredible. And the questions you've asked are so great. Like my brain's ticking around some of the things you've pulled out of the script. It's really powerful and exciting when something that I know Dom and I have had lots of conversations about, and I know had been written a certain way, and then to have people react and pull out those subtle, like it's quite a subtle film, but those subtleties
Yeah.
is really great. It like makes me feel really great. So
Oh, that's great. Oh,
thank
I'm
you.
glad. You're welcome. And again, as I've said, like anytime, I've loved the work that you've done. And Have a Car Seat was just, oh gosh, I'm still so in awe of that. And one of the things which I'll ask you about in a moment, Dom, is talking about working with Matthew. And I did an interview with Matthew earlier in the year, and it was so bizarre. Like I'll say this one thing very quickly, and then I'll let you go, JC. But was so bizarre because it's like I'm just a small website, right? And so, and I'm like, oh, Matthew Chong's like this, like he's phenomenal. Like we know that
Absolutely.
he's phenomenal, right? And then he's like, oh yeah, I listen to your work, I read your work, I'm so excited by what you do and all this stuff. I'm like, how do you know who I am? Anyway, we had a lovely conversation. That'll go up around the same time that this chat will go up too. But he's so delightful. I could spend hours talking
Lovely.
with him about his work.
Oh,
And the way that
incredible.
he sees the world is so good. Yeah. So thank you again. Anything you need. And I'll send you over the questions as well for Annalise, probably over
Oh,
the weekend too. Yeah.
thank you, Andrew, and ditto. Yeah, Matt's an absolute legend.
You're welcome.
I will leave you guys to it, and thanks so much again. And
No
yeah,
worries.
chat soon.
All right.
Bye.
Bye. But I do want to talk about Matthew Chung. It's a great time to then mention him because the way that he shoots and sees the world through the director's perspective is quite something. He's really tender and gentle with the way that he looks at the world, that he presents people on screen, especially young people as well. Like Half a Khasi, he's dealing with a young child in that film. in your film, he's got these two young teens. And the way that he shoots them is in such a gentle, considered way. What's it like working with him?
I mean, you're absolutely right. I think Matt has just an extraordinary eye. He's so deeply talented, I think, at what he does. And I loved Hafakazi too. And I thought that was just such a beautiful film that Addo made. It was really special. I mean, it was amazing working with Matt. You know, he does bring this really lovely, gentle eye, I think, to stories. And that was really important for Hal. I think, as Josie kind of said, it's not a you know, in your face film. It's quite a quiet film in many ways. And so I think Matt's work and approach worked really beautifully for that. I mean, I just felt so, I think, lucky and privileged and confident that Matt would hold space for what we needed through the story and would bring that to life beautifully. Like, I never had any doubt. And I think he did. You know, I think it's a beautiful, it looks beautiful, you know. And I think the choice of the way that we shot it, you know, we set for 360 across the board, and then we would get into the room and play around with the actors and kind of follow them through the action. Yeah, I was really excited to work with Matt in that way. And it's all pretty close. I'm sure you've noticed. Like, we're pretty tight on Daisy for a lot of the film and on the girls for a lot of the film. And that was an intentional choice because I think it is really intense, particularly when you're a teenager, you know, and the kinds of things that are happening to you. You don't necessarily have the perspective that you might have when you're older. Like, it's just all happening to you in that moment. So we wanted to stay really tight on Daisy and on the girls through that work. But yeah, Matt's amazing. I mean, look at his body of work, you know, it's just extraordinary. He's so talented, and I think he brings, yeah, something really unique to film.
Yeah, it really does. Which then leads me to the last thing that I want to talk about with Hal, which is Ingrid and working with Ingrid and building up Daisy as a character. And I know for a lot of people, they'd be familiar with her from Late Night with the Devil. And I watched Hal and I didn't realize that it was Ingrid because I tend to read who the cast is after it and stuff. And then I was like, who is this person? She's phenomenal. Just wow. Like, what a discovery. And then I'm like, oh, it's Ingrid Torelli. Okay, cool. No worries. She looks different. Clearly doesn't have all the horror makeup on and all this kind of stuff. But she's given the space to be able to create a character and build a character who I feel that she understands and on a really deep level. So what was it like building up and creating Daisy with her as an actor?
It was really special. You know, I hadn't seen actually any of Ingrid's work before we cast her. I still haven't seen Late Night with the Devil. I really need to watch it. It's top of my list. But Josie had seen Ingrid in a short film, just in a really small part in a short film, and she saw something. She thought, oh, there's something in Ingrid that just feels really complex and kind of sitting beneath the surface, and thought she had a really powerful presence. So we sent her the script, and she just loved it. You know, we had an online Zoom call and with her and her mom, and they loved the script so much. And we did, you know, some run-throughs online, and I immediately knew that she was Daisy. I just, yeah, on the spot was like, that's it. And it was amazing to work with her. You know, she's really committed. She brings a lot to the role. I think it was also really great for me because Daisy's obviously a queer role, and Ingrid is queer too. So I think it brought a lot of authenticity to that. And I think Ingrid understood Daisy. You know, she understood the character. She understood what they were going through. Both Ingrid and Christina, who plays Lila, you know, I think they were 16 and 17 at the time that we shot. And there was something about being that younger age that I think brought a sense of kind of naivety to the role that was really important to see on screen, that really shone through in their auditions as well. So they were amazing to work with. They were also really, like, you know, it was really important for the friendship between Daisy and Lila to come through, that chemistry to come through on screen, because really the whole film is built around that. And they were really beautiful. You know, we didn't do a lot of rehearsals, but we kind of hung out. We had lunch. You know, we spoke about the film. They went out on a shopping date and kind of built up that relationship. So they spent time just hanging out as people and as friends. And that was a dream really for me because that shone through in the film. You know, that friendship really came through. So yeah, I'm really excited. Ingrid couldn't make it to Berlin, which was sad, but Christina did come over for it, and I can't wait to see what Ingrid does next because she's awesome to work with.
Yeah, she's like, I mean, Australia's always had a great, like, ground of building up great actors, and particularly, you know, embracing and showing what the actresses in Australia can actually do. And I'm just like, I'm excited to see what she does because, specifically, like, Late Night with the Devil, there's Laura Gordon's in that, and there is, and interestingly enough, Laura Gordon's also in Hafikasi, and obviously, different age groups, but I feel like this connection between what Laura's been able to do with her career and this kind of work that I think that Ingrid would be doing is similar to what Laura does, which is just exploring these really, really deep characters in different ways. And I'm just thrilled to be able to see what she does going forward. But you talk about that friendship and the relationship, and that's what I love about the film too, is that you can feel that, like, there feels like there's points where the friendship could be breaking, right? But as you said, like, it's an ode to friendship. And at the end, that beautiful scene where they're singing and in the car, and it's just like, no, actually, they're going to be okay. Like, because friendships aren't always going to be, you know, straight roads. There are going to be some bumps along the way. And as long as they can return to one another, they'll be okay. And it's just beautiful. They're both really fantastic on screen. Have so much chemistry with one another. As you're saying, friendship is really strong, but that's also something you can't fake sometimes, and it feels authentic and real. And it underpins everything. Oh gosh, it's so good. Yeah. So yeah, lots to be proud of, Tom. I really appreciated it. Yeah.
You. I'm so glad. Yeah, it's a joy. Honestly, it's a joy and a privilege to make films. It's every time I'm on set, I feel so lucky to be there. So I'm always glad. Like, I know that no film is for everyone. Like, people connect to different films for different reasons, but anytime that someone connects to something that I've had the privilege of making, it really means so much to me. So thank you so much, Andrew.
Thanks for listening to this chat with Dominie Marshall and Josie Baines. Their films Howl and Stranger Brother screening at MIFF 2025. Visit miff.com.au for more details. Visit thecurb.com.au for other interviews and reviews. And please rate, review and share this interview with your film loving friends. We hope they like it as much as you have. I'm Andrew F. Pierce, and I'll see you on the next one.